From the National Library of Australia, this is The Memory Tapes, and I'm Dr. Sherlene Robinson.
And we're recording.
Here we go. Well, what do I say first?
How we won marriage equality in this country.
It was Gough-Whitlam, it was feminism. They were incredible times.
To Aborigines, we do not own the land. The land owns us because we are part of the land.
It's also an inspiring story about how a small group of people took on a superpower and won.
That was when I began to get worried. I saw that image on the radar, Cyclone Tracy.
Australia is a land that has been shaped by migrants. Before this and throughout, First Nations people have cared for this country for millennia. By the late 18th century, though, two vastly different worlds would meet on these shores, one deeply rooted in country, the other driven by exploration, empire, and ambition. That meeting changed both forever, setting in motion stories of dispossession, resilience, and transformation that continue to shape the nation today. In the years that followed, migration would continue to redefine what Australia was and what it could be. From the earliest arrivals of convicts and free settlers, through to the rigid hierarchies of race formalised through the White Australia policy and the dictation test, migration reflected both exclusion and opportunity. After the Second World War, the slogan, "Populate or Perish," brought a new wave of arrivals. Displaced peoples from war-torn Europe. At first, the so-called beautiful Balts with the 10-pound Poms, followed by Southern European families who helped to build the nation's industries and suburbs. By 1973, Australia began to reimagine itself once again as a multicultural nation, later shaped by the experiences of Vietnamese asylum seekers fleeing conflict and subsequent refugees seeking safety and belonging. But the promise of inclusion has never been consistent. There has been contestation, detention, and resistance against inclusion that continues into the present. Across each generation, migration has represented an opportunity not always seized, and offer to meet worlds in ways that remake and enrich Australia's identity in profound and unexpected ways. Through it all, this story has unfolded on lands long cared for by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people whose sovereignty, languages, and cultures endure as the first and continuing story of this continent. And within the stories of migration, of departure and arrival, loss and renewal, lie the voices that remind us of who we are. These voices are preserved in sound, carried across generations. Brought to you by the National Library of Australia, this is The Memory Tapes. I'm Dr. Sherlene Robinson. In this series, we explore the people and the moments that shaped Australia through the voices of those who were there. In this episode, we begin with what is believed to be the oldest surviving recording of a migrant describing their voyage to this continent, and then move forward to contemporary voices that speak to both the heartbreak and the hope of building a new life. We'll hear of migration journeys blighted by discrimination and prejudice, and affirming journeys where Australia offered security and friendship. Migration has always been about more than movement. It's about what people carry with them and what they leave behind. Here, we turn to the voices that remember those journeys, the voices that connect memory and migration across generations. We begin with an extraordinary voice that recalls migration before Australia even became a nation. It is likely one of the oldest memories of migration ever recorded on tape. From there, we move through the decades, hearing how experiences of arrival, belonging, and identity have changed. We'll also hear how, in many ways, they have not. These are stories of imagination, endurance, and reinvention, the threads that run through the long story of who we are. Let's begin then with that remarkable recording of Matthew Ryan, who travelled from Ireland to Australia in 1897 at the age of 23, before this country was even a nation. He tells of a chance meeting with a relative in an Irish town in a state of flux that changed his destiny.
I had in my mind I was about to go to America, and a relative of mine met me in the city of Limerick, and he told me that he had his passage paid to Australia. I thought the matter over, and I went and paid my passage, and I came away with him. And we both came out, and we landed here in this country on the 1st of April. I found it very hard to get work in Australia when I landed.
Matthew Ryan had arrived just as Australia was experiencing a devastating 1890s economic depression. He describes firsthand seeing men with their swags, bedrolls, carrying their worldly goods. These were the desperate men described in Andrew Banjo Patterson's unofficial national anthem, Waltzing Matilda.
Once a jolly swagman camped,
setting off on foot in desperate search of work.
But in those days, when I first came, there was a lot of people leaving the city of Sydney. They were going to West Australia. Some were going to America. Others were hoisting their swag and going on to the railway lines looking for work.
Ultimately, Matthew Ryan's life in Australia was a happy one. He married, he worked as a blacksmith and in horseshoeing. He had many supportive relatives in the country. His career meant that he did eventually sustain some hearing loss and also dealt with typhoid fever. Yet, he helped to build the Glebe Bridge, worked on the cane fields, and retired financially secure in a climate that he liked. Matthew Ryan's story takes us to a time before the 20th century, when migration was largely, although not exclusively, from Britain and Ireland. After the discovery of gold in 1851 through to the 1880s, when racist sentiment saw parts of Australia place restrictions on Chinese immigration, significant numbers of Chinese immigrants sought opportunity here. But by the latter half of the 19th century, racist attitudes had hardened and whiteness was considered the marker of belonging. When Australia became a nation in 1901, one of its first acts was to close the doors, the Immigration Restriction Act. This would become part of what is known as the White Australia Policy. This law restricted non-white migration and allowed for the deportation of so-called undesirable residents already in the country. British migration was favoured, and a dictation test in any language a potential migrant could not speak was used to exclude others. As a result, non-white people, including Australia's Indigenous population, made up only about 2% of the overall population by the early 1940s. In 1993, Eddie Kwong told the extraordinary story of his courageous grandmother who had travelled to Australia from China at the age of 16 in the late 1800s for an arranged marriage with Eddie's grandfather. Her search for a new life began as racist exclusion was escalating, yet she met challenges with bravery, initiative, and determination. Chin Fong Toi became Fong Nun Choi Toit after marriage. Eddie Kwong remembers the migration story his grandmother shared with him when he was a child.
Now, she came over on a ship to Port Darwin, or Palmerston, but apparently, this is what she's told me and my family and my sisters who verified it, is that when she got here, she found out that her papers weren't in order. right, for some reason or other. So she jumped ship, and she used to tell us a story of where her family, the family that brought her over, accompanied her over, hid her in a little dinghy and rowed her down to a place called Fanny Bay Beach, well, where Fanny Bay Beach is. There they went by ox tray. It took several days to get to a place called Pine Creek, where the goldfields are.
Her journey took her from the coast to the goldfields, a long, harsh route through heat and dust. With her new husband, she set up a farm at Pine Creek. Eddie Kwong describes the important contribution this made to the community.
Now, Pine Creek, they had a farm there, and they grew rice, they grew vegetables, they grew Chinese vegetables, mainly fruit and vegetables, and they became self-supporting, and they supported the great population of Chinese down there, plus the white population, all other populations as well. So they had to grow their own vegetables. And the Chinese from the Guangdong province, they were experts. And my grandmother used to always say that as a little girl, she was always growing vegetables and knew exactly how vegetables are grown.
While she may have helped an emerging community survive through the provision of food, she still faced discrimination.
There was no hospital. And my grandmother used to say how the white people used to segregate them completely. The Chinese were only used for farmers, labourers, laundry, or wherever they can eke a living, but they were never allowed to go into the white department stores or stores or the white hospitals.
While prejudice was rife from European settlers, Eddie's family found acceptance and friendship from Aboriginal people.
My mother was actually had been to the Aboriginal ceremonies, and I think she was born near an Aboriginal camp.
In many parts of Australia, relationships between Chinese people and Aboriginal people were shaped by mutual respect and the shared experience of living outside of the margins of a society that excluded them both. Through these quiet acts of connection, new forms of belonging began to take root in Australia's frontiers. Relationships that remind us that Australia's history of connection did not begin with colonisation, but with a millennia of First Nations exchange and care for country. In 1945, a new chapter of migration began. After the devastation of the Second World War and fears that Australia's relatively low population would prevent it from defending itself in conflict, Australia opened its doors under the Populate or Perish policy. That year, the Australian government announced that it would be seeking both British and other European migrants. Between 1945 and 1965, 2 million immigrants arrived in Australia. The majority were British who had registered for subsidised migration. But between 1947 and 1952, 170,000 displaced people in refugee camps in Eastern Europe were selected by Commonwealth officials and brought to Australia. The term beautiful bolts was coined to describe these first displaced persons. They were required to work for the Australian government for 2 years, and in return, they received food, accommodation, education, and health services, as well as a standard wage. After, they were free to remain in the country or to return to Europe. In the years after their arrival, migration policies slowly changed to first allow migrants from southern and eastern Europe, and then, from the late 1940s and early 1950s, carefully selected temporary migrants from the Middle East and Asia. Millions of people sailed south to rebuild their lives in a distant land that promised safety and economic opportunity. In 1950, Anna Petrowski, originally from Poland, arrived in Australia with her mother aboard the Fairsea. She was just 3.5 years old when they reached Port Melbourne and were sent to the Bonegilla Migrant Reception Centre near Albury Wodonga.
I remember Bonegilla quite well and Australia, so I was 3.5.
Bonegilla was the first home for more than 300,000 new arrivals between 1947 and 1971. It was a former army camp that had been turned into a temporary village. For children like Anna, it was the beginning of an unfamiliar life under a hot Southern Sun.
When we got to Bonabigilla, I think they're called Nissen huts. Is that what they're sort of corrugated iron huts that the army had used, and they had two families per hut, and they were just very, very hot. Very hot, especially for people that had come out sort of from, a European winter. Yeah, just the heat and the dust and the flies, and that sort of worried them a bit. But, I mean, they were happy to have freedom.
Freedom came with heat, dust and uncertainty, but also with the joy of beginning again. From those metal huts at Bonegilla, families like the Petrowskis would move across the country, helping to build the suburbs, industries and communities of post-war Australia. Leaving home could provoke powerful, conflicting emotions. For the post-war British migrants who'd registered for the Assisted Passage Migration Scheme, dubbed £10 POMS, the journey was meant to be one of opportunity, but the leaving itself could be heartbreaking. In 1953, Kathleen Golder left post-war England with her husband and young children, determined to begin a new life in Australia.
The date for our departure did not come as early as it could have done, and I was getting on to 6 months pregnant, and I said, I'll get on that boat. If it's the last damn thing I'll do, I'll get on. I don't care if I'm in labour, I'll get on that boat. But I happened to have had the baby 2 weeks before we got on the boat. So I got on the boat with this new baby. And I was stood, it was raining, as it would be in London in November, this baby, you know. And I was crying, crying, oh dear me. I didn't want to leave, really. You know, it was my home, it was my family, my brothers and everything, all my family were there. I didn't want to leave, but it was the best thing I ever did, but I didn't know it then.
Kathleen's memory captures both the grief of departure and the hope of arrival, the emotional crossroads faced by so many who left behind the familiar for the unknown. For some, that journey meant freedom. For others, it meant loneliness and loss. And for their children, growing up in the years that followed, it meant learning to belong in a country that was still uncertain of its own identity. By the late 1950s, the children of post-war migrants were growing up in a country still learning how to define itself. For many, the playground became the first test of identity, a place where accents, names and even your lunches could mark you as different. Richard Gallier was born in Sydney in 1958 to parents who had migrated from Malta just 3 years earlier. He remembers that being considered different could come at a cost.
We often had some huge fights together in the school grounds, but nearly always it was because of the WOG word.
It was a word that for a generation of migrant children could wound deeply.
Oh, it used to, you know, be like just very, very painful, very hurt, very, very hurtful. It was probably the worst word in the vocabulary, actually, for me. I just always wanted to be Australian. All my friends, my best friends were, you know, the second, third generation Australian. And I just wanted to be an Australian, to be honest.
Like many second-generation Australians, Richard Gallier's story is one of negotiation between heritage and acceptance, between pride and the desire to blend in.
People, they're a beautiful race of people. They're very generous, very loving, and you very rarely find someone who can say a bad word against Maltese people, to be honest.
Sometimes Australian ideas went too far. May Britt Mosshammer, who migrated to Australia from Denmark, drew one important line, Australian food.
And then my brother was saying to me, hey, you have to try these crumpets with this, chocolate-looking kind of stuff on, which was Vegemite. And I thought it looked chocolatey, so I expected it to be very sweet. So he made me some crumpets with Vegemite, And I thought, that was the most disgusting thing I ever had. I just spat it out. I said, it's like bread with star cubes smeared on it. It was just weirdest food.
For her, it was the people who made Australia her home.
And I felt that that has been really very often the case in Australia, that people have helped me, you know. They were never sort of like, oh, it's none of my business. They could really see that they really were very empathetic. And been out of their way often. You know, I really, you know what? More than anything, I think that's where I start falling in love with the country.
Right.
It was the humanity side. It was certainly not the, you know, the country and the food and, you know, and it was none of that. It was the people.
Over time, the pride that once sat quietly at home, in kitchens filled with different food and voices from other lands, became part of the broader Australian story itself. In 1973, the White Australia policy officially ended when Prime Minister Gough Whitlam's Minister for Immigration, Al Grassby, introduced the policy of multiculturalism to Parliament. For those who were escaping conflict and war, Australia offered not only opportunity but refuge. The fall of Saigon and the end of the Vietnam War saw a wave of refugees seeking asylum. On the 26th of April, 1976, the first boatload of refugees fleeing Vietnam sailed into Darwin Harbour, heralding a series of arrivals over the next few years. Most refugees from Vietnam arrived by plane after they had been selected by Australian officials from refugee camps that were established through Southeast Asia. These refugees endured perilous journeys with great courage. One woman who made an extraordinary voyage was Van Thi Thi Huyen, who fled Vietnam after the fall of Saigon in 1975. With her two sons, both gravely ill, she boarded a crowded fishing boat bound for Malaysia. Their voyage would test every limit of human endurance. They were attacked by Thai pirates and forced overboard. Van Thi Thi Huyen swam through the dark waters to a nearby island, carrying her children to safety. For 3 days they survived there until the United Nations rescued them, arranging for her sons to receive urgent medical care. Eventually, they were accepted as refugees to Australia.
When I was in the interview, the interpreter knew we were accepted, and he said to us, why you go to Australia? It's a very, very big country, but not many people. And you see, if you live in the country, it's very boring. But we didn't mind at all. We just very happy and knew we were accepted.
For Van Thi Thi Huyen and thousands like her, Australia was more than a destination. It represented safety, renewal, and a fragile kind of peace. Such stories would help to shape a new understanding of who could call this country home. By the 1970s, migration to Australia reflected a broader world, one in which identity could no longer be contained by one single story or a single place. For many, home existed in two countries at once. Everest Pitt, who migrated from Fiji to Queensland in 1974, has come to see herself as both Fijian and Australian.
I loved everything about Australia. Still do. Like, to me, if it was like, which country would you die for? Well, I'd put one foot in Fiji and one foot in Australia. I would die like that. Because I've given over 48 years of my life to the country.
Her words speak to the layered belonging that defines modern Australia, where identity stretches across oceans, memories, and generations. In voices like hers, we hear the long arc of migration come full circle, from arrival and exclusion to belonging and pride. From the 1980s, classrooms were becoming small mirrors of a changing Australia. For many new arrivals, belonging didn't come from blending in, but from finding others who also stood a little apart. Sevaloni Wangatairiwa, who was born in 1970 and migrated from Fiji to Sydney while in primary school, remembers finding comfort in that shared distance.
There were Indigenous children that went to the school with me, so that gave me a sense of comfort. There were other brown skin kids around, and we were taught Indigenous culture classes. We had language classes. And this is back in 1981. When I was at the school. So that was really great to get that. It was a very different experience, but at least I felt identified and connected.
For Sevaloni, those early connections were built on recognition, a quiet solidarity between communities who shared the experience of being seen as outsiders. It was through that mutual understanding that a new sense of belonging began to grow, not about sameness, but about shared respect and resilience. By the end of the 20th century, new forms of migration were reshaping Australia. Conflict, persecution, and instability in places like Afghanistan and Iraq drove thousands to seek safety far from home. Among them were Hazara families, a Shia Muslim minority in Afghanistan who had long faced discrimination and violence under the Taliban rule. For many, escape meant leaving everything behind. One of those who fled was Mustafa Jawadi, born in Kabul in 1991. His story is one of courage, fear, and the long wait for safety. When the Taliban came to power, his family faced persecution and fled Afghanistan, first to Iran, but life there was also unsafe. And when his father couldn't secure a visa to Australia, he obtained false passports so they could travel through Malaysia to Indonesia. After a month in Surabaya, they were awoken one night and told that their boat was ready. The journey was terrifying. It was overcrowded, seas were rough, they had little sleep. After 8 days at sea, they reached Australian waters, only to be told by the Australian Navy that they could not enter and must turn back. When smoke rose from the deck, panic spread.
Suddenly the big smoke came out from the deck. I didn't know what's happening, and I went around the boat a bit with my dad to find a life jacket. Our family, we just jumped together because my dad was the only one who could swim properly. Like, he knew a bit how to swim. I didn't know, my mom didn't know. So we jumped together, and when we jumped, we were underwater for 30 minutes, and we saw the Australian Navy came back with the boat, started picking us out, and it took them to pick us up at least an hour, and they took us to their Navy ship, and we stayed there. When they got everyone out, and they said two women died, and everyone was worried, who is it, and they went and looked, and there was an old woman, she was around her 80s, and there was a young woman pregnant.
The family was taken first to Christmas Island, then to Nauru, where Mustafa spent 3 years in detention before finally being resettled in Canberra. Since then, he has undertaken studies and has reflected on the complex ways his family's journey has played out. He says his parents,
they feel very happy. They're more excited. The only thing is just that they miss our family back in Iran and Afghanistan. I just want to meet them again. It's been 7 years now, so I haven't seen them.
Even in safety, the distance remains between what was gained and what was lost. Migration brings many challenges, and distance has long been one. Even as travel became easier and Australia grew more connected to the world, distance could still be an ache that never quite went away. For many migrants, maintaining ties with family and friends overseas remained a costly and an emotional challenge, a reminder of just how far home really was. Mohan Parasu, who migrated to Australia from India with his wife in 1992, remembers those early years vividly.
In the initial years, it was really tough because the only way we could talk to somebody is by telephone, international calls. and they were very expensive. Like I remember, I think it was $2.60 per minute. And we used to, this especially the first 4 months of our stay in Australia, because we were living off the government allowance, we used to budget for so many minutes to get in touch with the family, to let them know that we are fine here and things like that.
Those short, precious calls carried whole worlds, reassurance, yearning and love.
Across the crackling phone lines.
In recent times, there is video calls. It's like so cheap and so available now. So it's communication is not a problem anymore.
For Mohan Parasu, the distance that once felt insurmountable has been replaced by instant connection. Yet the emotion of those first years remains part of his story. Migration is no longer just a physical journey. It is one way of staying connected across time and technology. Across more than two centuries, Australia's migration story has never been steady. It's moved forward and it's slipped back. There have been moments of generosity and moments of great fear and prejudice. Times when we opened our arms and others when we closed our borders and our hearts. Those exclusionary moments are not in the distant past, but they play out in different ways today. Over time, we have welcomed those in need. We have also detained them. And through it all, people have continued to come. They have crossed oceans and deserts, carrying languages, songs, and memories. They have rebuilt lives from loss and created belonging from uncertainty. Their endurance and imagination have helped to reshape this country, not perfectly, but profoundly. Migration is more than the movement of people. It's the movement of memory, of ideas, of courage, of endurance. These are now part of the Australian story. They are our memory tapes. This is a story that remains uneven, conflicted, and unfinished. But in the meeting of many worlds is something enduring. Even in the face of fear and setback, people keep reaching for connection and opportunity. In that reaching, they keep remaking who we are. Voices of migration tell us not only where we have come from, but who we are still becoming. You've been listening to The Memory Tapes. I'm Dr. Charlene Robinson. Thank you to the National Library of Australia and to those many voices whose journeys continue to shape our shared history. If these voices spoke to you, share them. Tell someone about the stories of migration that helped shape modern Australia. The journeys, the challenges, and the hopes that continue to define who we are. Subscribe, and if you can, leave a review. It helps these stories find their way to more ears, carrying forward the voices of all those who made this country home. This has been a National Library of Australia production.